and welcome to the latest edition of the RBC podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. My name's Mark Cleesby, and today I'm talking with the Principal of the Royal Veterinary College, Professor Quinton McKellar, and endeavouring to find out some of his thoughts about the future of veterinary education and the veterinary profession. Thanks very much for joining us today, Quinton. I thought I'd ask you to start with what you see as some of the major challenges or trends that are actually facing us in veterinary education at the moment.
I think the biggest one is in terms of actually educating students is the content overload that has crept upon us. And this is something that happens, I guess, every 20 or 25 years, both in veterinary medicine and medical subjects. And it's associated essentially with the growth of information. I think Stephen May was telling me recently that there's as much information now, electronic information now, or there's 3 million times as much electronic information now available as there is in all the books ever written.
Is that right?
And so, in a sense, the possibility of us being able to transmit information directly to students and the sort of volume that is potentially available is just not existent. It doesn't exist. And we've got to actually think of other ways of teaching them in such a way that students and graduates will learn throughout their lives and adapt as information becomes available. And they're going to have to be able to, I think, filter information very much more effectively, utilise information which is appropriate, and do that on behalf of clients and behalf of society. So I think that's probably the major thing. And in terms of doing that, certainly at the Royal Veterinary College, obviously we've gone through now 2 years of the revised curriculum, mm-hmm. which is designed to try and ensure that the students understand basic principles, but are also given a sufficient level of factual information which will allow them at graduation, or allow us at graduation, to be confident in them to be able to perform day one skills which have been defined.
So really the emphasis has shifted somewhat from a very detailed level of knowledge to adopting the skills that will be necessary to subsequently develop the knowledge.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Does that imply, therefore, that it's unrealistic now to regard a current veterinary graduate as the cliché omnicompetent?
Well, it absolutely is completely inappropriate to regard a current graduate as omnicompetent. But I would suggest that has been the case for many years. Mm. Whether it's ever been really appropriate to regard someone who's just graduated as omnicompetent, I think, is debatable. But certainly in the current environment, it's just not tenable to think that we could produce graduates who would be completely competent to do all the potential things that vets could be required to do in the whole variety of job environments that they might find themselves. And in essence, I think the best we can hope for is to produce vets with the appropriate potential to develop skills in the different areas which they might end up working in. And I guess that means that we've got to also, as well as actually within the universities, creating an appropriate environment for undergraduate education, I think we've got to be thinking much more seriously now about continuing professional development, how we continue to support vets once they've gone in either into practice or into academia or research or whichever environment they end up in.
Yes, and I guess that's inevitably becoming increasingly formalised and will continue to do so.
Yeah.
So what, on that basis, to what extent then is curriculum tracking now actually taking place in UK veterinary schools, and is this going to be something that will continue to evolve? So will we end up with separate streams doing farm animal and small animal work, for example?
Let me come on to specialisation, as it's referred to, in a moment. In terms of where we are at present, my understanding is that the Royal Veterinary College does a substantially greater amount of what could be classified as tracking, but at the moment is embraced within our elective programmes,
yeah.
than do the other vet schools in the UK, but certainly less than some of our sister vet schools abroad. So, for instance, Utrecht has a much more robust tracking mm-hmm. process than we do in any of the schools in the UK. At present in the UK, in the final year of the course, electives comprise about 25% of the total time. When we move into the new curriculum, the proposal is that it'll comprise, and it'll not just be electives, it'll also be specific rotational tracking, and the proposal is that that will comprise about 45% of the total top time in the final year. So it's moving to quite a significant proportion of at least the final year. In Utrecht, they track earlier, so they track from the early part of the course right through the course. We're still looking principally at the final year, or presenting opportunities for tracking in the final year. Now, what that might mean in terms of individuals graduating with, let's just say, strength in one area and potentially, because obviously they've focused in one area, weaknesses in other areas, remains to be developed. And I mean, the ultimate conclusion is obviously that there will be individuals graduate who would have competence in a specific area and be essentially less competent in another area. Mm-hmm. If that were to happen, and at a point when the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons or the European Associations were to consider it inappropriate to give vets the right to practice in all areas, then we'd end up in a situation where there would have to be some sort of limited licensure. Mm-hmm. And then we'd have true, probably species, but it could also be discipline-related tracking or specialisation. Now, there are arguments for and against that. If you think about it from the point of view of the general public, those wishing to get a very high level of service within a particular defined area might see specialisation or tracking as a positive thing, because mm-hmm. they would obviously potentially get a better service yeah. from an individual who had been trained more intensely in a specific animal species. From the veterinary student's point of view, it's currently considered to be a bad move, because they would wish themselves on graduation at least to have the potential to go into any branch of veterinary medicine without further education. So I think there's currently a little bit of a tension between what the public might expect and the direction that they might expect us to move in, and what the profession, and particularly the students that we're currently educating, might expect.
Yes, and I guess amongst students there's always been a feeling that or certainly amongst the majority, that they would like to start off at least in a sort of mixed practice type environment. I suppose, as you've already alluded to, the other issue is whether the RCVS will go along with this. Obviously, they still have demands in place in terms of being able to treat any species in an emergency, for example. So I guess there's a bit of evolution to go on there.
There is, but I mean, you'd have to ask yourself now if many small animal practitioners in the country, and I hesitate to say this, but would be fully competent, as would, for instance, an equine specialist to treat a horse in an emergency circumstance.
Absolutely.
They'd certainly be far better equipped than a member of the public, so that's appropriate. But, I think there are some quite difficult questions to be asked there.
Okay, so in terms of, on as a related subject, how the type of graduate that we produce these days is changing. What are the main changes that are actually taking place in teaching methodology these days, and how we are actually producing these students?
Yeah. Well, as we suggested earlier, because of a growth of information, there's been a tendency within each of the disciplines within the veterinary course to try and cram as much of that information into students. And we're currently trying to move to a position where we create space, if you like, for students not only to acquire an appropriate amount of information, but also to think and to develop understanding of their subject.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a move as a consequence of that from very large number of didactic lectures towards a more blended approach to learning. So as well as lecturing to students, there are now self-directed and reflective learning approaches being utilised. We are developing, certainly at the Royal Veterinary College, both pastoral and academic tutorial environment in which the students hopefully will learn. We're utilising a lot of electronic delivery techniques which hopefully will allow students to learn on their own. And also, as we move through into the clinical years, there are two approaches being adopted. One, which is pure problem-based learning, which in a certain environment has a specific meaning. But I think, certainly at the Royal Veterinary College, it's likely that we'll adopt education in client-enhanced or patient-enhanced environment rather than a specific problem-based type environment. So in essence, we'll assume that our clinicians will be educating perhaps with the patient and the students together in a single environment. So the sort of things that we've had previously in rotations will be extended, and also extended back down through the course in order to stimulate the imagination of students at earlier parts of the veterinary course. So those are all being embraced, I think, as methods of teaching and put into a sort of blended matrix that we'll be utilising to deliver for the students, and also stripping material out to allow them actually to go and think on their own.
Yeah, so I guess this involves then a lot of sort of small group learning amongst the students themselves, but I guess also if staff are involved on a small group basis and with the student numbers, then one's obviously going to require quite a large staff input in terms of numbers in the later years as well.
Absolutely. Now we're quite fortunate because although the student numbers have increased substantially, particularly in the United Kingdom in the Royal Veterinary College, but also in many of the other schools in the UK, we've been fortunate because we've been able to increase academic staff numbers in an approximately proportional ratio. So we actually are able to deliver the same, if you like, contact hours that we have been delivering previously.
Okay. I guess it's probably not a big surprise to anyone out there that there are changes going on or have been over the last 10 or 20 years in the demographics of the student population. Perhaps you'd like to sort of comment on how that's been coming about and whether there are sort of measures in place that, or whether we feel we need to try and address these changes and even things out.
Well, the major factor that influences which students we take are which students apply and the grades that they have. And we've done some work to review whether the applicant base reflects the numbers and the particular demographics of the students who actually make it into the veterinary course, and essentially it does. So in essence, there's been a significant move in gender, so there's been a feminisation of the undergraduate body, and there's also, I don't know if it's been a move towards a different socioeconomic cohort of students, but there certainly in veterinary medicine has been a tendency towards middle class students coming into the veterinary course. So in essence we have about between 80 and 90% of our students are female, and the vast majority of them tend to come from middle class backgrounds. Now, whether there's any academic rationale for wishing to change the gender demographics of vet students, I'm very doubtful. I think actually I can't see any real rationale why we would wish to do that.
Right.
There certainly is a rationale in terms of the student social experience, particularly where you have an isolated campus like we have here at Hawkshead, simply because it's, I think, appropriate for a student population to have a reasonably balanced gender mix, just in terms of their social interaction, personal development, and all that sort of thing. Absolutely. Now, the issue around the socioeconomic bias is slightly different, because we have been instructed by government to try as best we can to attract individuals from educationally disadvantaged backgrounds into the veterinary course, and we've been very active in doing that. That's not to say we wouldn't wish to do it anyway, but it's been a specific policy of government to try and attract people. And the difficulty with that, of course, in any sort of social engineering, which essentially it is, in any sort of social engineering exercise, is to find a criterion which is essentially fair in terms of how you actually attract individuals and from what particular background you try and attract them. At the college here, we've developed a gateway program which essentially involves students from essentially what we've classified as disadvantaged backgrounds, where their parents have not had experience of higher education and where they've come from state schools.
Mm-hmm.
We've attracted those students potentially with poorer A grade results than those coming directly into the course into our gateway program. We take about 30 students a year into that program. They're given a programme of education at the end of which they're examined, and if they're successful in passing that examination, which is essentially equivalent to that which we've utilised for the direct intake to first year, then they will be guaranteed a place in the first year of the course here, or at one of at least two other UK vet schools in Liverpool or Bristol.
So they're effectively getting an extra year just to get them up to the level we would like them to start at.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Now, obviously, all this with education and in terms of research involves a great deal of money, essentially, and university fees obviously assisted with that in recent years. But how do you regard the level of funding actually being with regard to other disciplines, for example, other courses? Do you find that you are having to budget very carefully and to compromise in places, or how are you sort of thinking in terms of attracting extra funding, perhaps?
Yeah. Well, the first thing to say about funding is that veterinary students attract Band A funding, which essentially means that they get a high level of funding relative to science students and art students.
Mm-hmm.
So their funding is aligned with that of medical and dental students. And I think that's appropriate because you can only really compare the courses that our vet students do with those of medical and dental students, particularly because of the very biologically rich environment in the early part of the course and the clinically rich environment that they have to be exposed to in the later part of the course. And that requires a significantly higher level of resource than it would for most of the other basic sciences or arts courses.
Yes.
So comparing us to medical students, in fact, we are significantly underfunded in terms of the public unit of resource that comes into the college. In medical courses, there's a stream of funding which is called the service increment for teaching. And that goes into teaching hospitals and is essentially there to subsidise the teaching hospital for the resource required to undertake the teaching. We don't have that stream of funding.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have had to do is attract through the private sector, essentially, through our hospitals, the appropriate clinical material to create the environment to teach our students.
Yeah.
And in essence, when you work it out, when you actually determine how much money comes into our hospitals and is therefore utilised in the teaching of students, we're subsidising each of our students to the tune of about £22,000 through the private investment, if you like, that's being made in the hospitals.
Okay, because obviously the hospitals are run as a business, but obviously a byproduct of that is case material that the students will learn from.
Absolutely. I would probably turn it the other way around, in that the hospitals are run as teaching hospitals, and the very fortunate byproduct of it is that we can actually make them perform as businesses.
Yeah. Okay. And if one then moves on to think about research, both in terms of funding and in terms of general standards, the research assessment exercise was published not so long ago, which is a system of rankings basically for departments and their competence, if you like, in research outcomes. And how did veterinary research fare in this?
So in the research assessment exercise, the whole of the higher education sector was divided up into units of assessment and subunits of assessment. The veterinary schools were assessed together with agriculture and food sciences in one of the subunits. And it's quite easy to compare us within that subunit. And in fact, the vet schools, out of the 30 submissions to the subunit that the vet schools were in, Edinburgh University Vet School came second, the Royal Veterinary College came third, Glasgow Vet School came fourth, and Liverpool Vet School came fifth. And all the vet schools were in the top third
mm-hmm.
of those 30 submissions. So within our unit of assessment, we did extremely well. It's rather more difficult to determine how we did relative to other units because
yeah.
we were obviously being compared with things like archaeology and with medical subjects, mathematics, with engineering. And there was no correction factor put into the system which would have allowed, if you like, weighting of one against the other. So it's actually not really possible to determine where we sit, I don't believe, against the other units of assessment. We can only really look at it internally within the unit in which we were compared.
I suppose one of the other issues that is of great interest to the profession and stirs up a lot of debate in the veterinary record, for example, is potential reform of the Veterinary Surgeons Act. Now, do you believe that this is something that is necessary or needs to have a lot of effort put into it, and what specifically do you think is wrong with it at the moment?
Mm-hmm. Well, I believe that the general public in the UK consider the veterinary profession in a very good light. Mm. I think they think we're very professional, I think they think we're a caring profession, and I think they think that we're relatively well run and organised.
Do you think that's changed in recent years?
In fact, I think we've always been considered well by the general public, and I think, you know, there have been some issues in which the veterinary profession has been involved which have perhaps not been viewed favourably by the public, and obviously the foot and mouth outbreak and BSE have been two of those. But by and large, in terms of the practising arm of the profession, we're considered very well by the public. Now, that, therefore, one might say the profession is essentially governed reasonably well. And I suspect on that basis you would say it's not essential that we review or revise the Veterinary Surgeons Act. There have, though, been a series of correspondences related in particular to the disciplinary process in which vets are involved or by which vets are potentially disciplined, which certainly I think it would be appropriate to review. And I say that because at the moment the way the Veterinary Surgeons Act cascades down into the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons, which if you like is the governing organ of the Veterinary Surgeons Act, means that the disciplinary body is predominantly made up of veterinary surgeons. Mm-hmm. As a consequence, there's always likely to be, by the general public, a feeling of nepotism. Are these veterinary surgeons genuinely disciplining appropriately their colleagues when there's been a complaint raised? And so I think there's definitely opportunity to increase the lay membership. Now, there's a balance that has to be achieved between ensuring appropriate expertise,
knowledge
and expertise on the disciplinary committee, against ensuring that there's sufficient transparency and sufficient confidence in the disciplinary process by the general public. And I think that needs to be reviewed. I think there's an issue in terms of overall leadership of the profession, which, if you think about what the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons is for, it's there to act on behalf of the public,
yes,
not actually to act on behalf of the profession. The representative organisation for the veterinary profession is the British Veterinary Association, but then it's very, very clearly representative of its members. And so there's no real, in my view, there's no real leadership of the profession from an independent perspective on behalf of the public. And I think that's where some of the other professions are ahead of us. For instance, in terms of the Royal Colleges within the medical profession, they are comprised of individuals of significant standing in one way or another across their profession, and they're able, as a consequence, because they're not involved in the disciplinary process, they're simply acting, if you like, as a leadership organ for their profession. And I think that's somewhere that we should go as a profession as well.
Mm-hmm. I suppose one of the other sort of subsections to the potential reform is regulation of paraprofessionals, of foot trimmers and barriers, etc., etc. Do you think that that's possible to bring them within the same umbrella, or, you know, I would imagine that they would be somewhat reluctant to that. I mean, in a situation where the number of paraprofessional tasks that are being undertaken out there is burgeoning, how do we regulate those? Should we regulate those?
And that, I think, is a really difficult question to answer. Certainly, within the college here, we have a very energetic veterinary nursing programme, mm-hmm. Which takes veterinary nurses from foundation level right through to advanced diploma level. And it's apparent, certainly to me, that they are developing their own profession, if you like, very adequately. And we would want to support them in doing so. Mm-hmm. But it's the level of granularity where you work down from veterinary nursing down to, you know, as you describe, hoof trimmers or whatever it might be. And whether and how those individuals are regulated, I think, is a much more difficult question, and one which I'm probably not competent to answer, to be perfectly honest.
Okay, well, we'll move on to discuss maybe one of the main issues that you raised in your recent talk at the Royal Society of Arts, and that's, I guess, the sort of rather large and thorny issue of changes in demographics, not only the animal population but the human population, in terms of the burgeoning numbers of people in the world and the demands that this is placing upon agriculture and the environment. And how do you think that veterinary surgeons are going to adjust their practice or their priorities to cope with these sorts of issues?
So the predictions are that the human population is going to increase from about 6 million to about 9 million over the next 40 odd years. And that, because most of that increase is going to happen in developing countries, and because as countries develop and become more prosperous, there's a move from cereal intake to meat intake, red meat and milk intake. Mm-hmm. The predictions are that there's going to be a requirement for roughly double the number of livestock to be reared globally. And that is clearly going to put huge pressures onto various resources, water, not just water, drinking water for the animals, but water obviously to irrigate crops which are being produced to feed animals. I think in terms of the environment and the environmental footprint, they reckon there's something like 18% of the greenhouse gas emissions, or the inappropriate greenhouse gas emissions, which are being produced at any one time, are being produced by livestock. Mm-hmm. So they're having a major impact. And of course, things like nitrogen on soil, leaching, causing eutrophication in water systems and so on. So the production of livestock in a sustainable way, moving towards a position where we're going to have to feed 9 billion people, is going to be a significant challenge. Personally, I think it can only be tackled by developing technologies, improving breeding, improving nutrition, and of course controlling disease. And I think vets have a significant part to play in all of those processes. I think it goes much further than that, because even if we were able to do all those things in the developed Western world, I still think we would not be able to address the growth in population. And I think it's going to be hugely important that there's actually stable political systems develop in many of the developing countries where those just simply don't exist at the present time. Mm-hmm. And those actually, stable politics and essentially prosperity, are the two things which will allow the technologies which might be developed, which could allow us to produce both crops and animals in the numbers that are going to be required to feed the populace in a sustainable and stable way, to actually be done. And unless that happens, I think we will have real problems moving into the next half century.
Yes, I mean, I suppose there are two opposing issues here in terms of the general movement, I suppose, in the Western world against intensification, and then numbers of animals that are going to be required, or areas of land that are going to be required just to feed the population must require intensification. Would you agree?
To some extent, I would. Certainly, and I think you have to consider ruminants separately from pigs and poultry. Mm-hmm. And for pigs and poultry, I think you're right. And in fact, both intensification and improvement, particularly in feed conversion ratios, so the amount of food required to produce each kilo of meat, are going to be the important things in terms of adequacy of production. And I think those have to be done in an appropriate ethical environment. So animal welfare concerns have to be embraced as we develop intensive systems which allow us to essentially undertake those increases in productivity. For ruminants, it's slightly different. I mean, at the present time, one of the major impacts on the environment is the fact that what we're actually doing is cutting down forests in order to create pasture land for, yes, ruminants. Now, much better were we able to utilise pasture land which is already there and not being utilised more effectively for ruminants. The problem we have is that it takes about 10 times as much energy to produce a kilo of meat as it does to produce a kilo of cereal, and consequently 10 times as much cereal to produce a kilo of meat. And it's much more efficient if we can utilise ruminants on forage land which is not appropriate for cereal production. So I think in terms of ruminants, we've got to look much more carefully at how we utilise uplands in areas which are not going to be effectively used for crops, rice, wheat, etc. Mm-hmm. I think that's what we've got to think about.
Okay, I thought I'd just finish then by asking you what you thought your key priorities were then as an educator, bearing, I guess, most of these issues we discussed in mind at the RBC.
So if I can turn it around slightly and say it's the output that I'm interested in, and I think in 10 years now, but I mean obviously as we move forward, what we really need to focus on is producing graduates who are going to make the biggest positive impact on society in a whole range of ways as possible. And if we can keep our sights focused on that, I think we'll do pretty well. And if I can just break that down a little, because you can look at that at a regional or a local level, at a national level, and probably at a global level as well. And if you take it at the local level, we want our graduates to be providing the very best service possible for their clients and their patients at the practice level. We also want to have educated them, I believe, appropriately to actually embrace issues of social importance. So not just veterinary issues. These are very bright graduates that we have. They will have had a university education when they leave here. And I hope that they'll involve themselves, not just in veterinary matters, but in matters of importance to society in general. So I think that's hugely important at a local level. At a national level, and in particular, following on from the last question, essentially, in terms of what contributions we're going to make to feeding a hugely expanded population, I think embracing technology in an appropriate and ethical way and ensuring that that technology is utilised by our agricultural systems in the UK to make them competitive, but also to make them ethically sound, is going to be hugely important. And I think ensuring that that's done in an appropriate environment where public health is at the forefront. We haven't really mentioned some of the potential huge problems of exotic and zoonotic disease, which are clearly going to increase because there's much greater trade and there's much greater movement of people across the world, and just simply more of both animals and people. And so that mix is likely to increase the potential for disease development, new diseases becoming important. And I think vets have a critical role to play in preventing those happen. Then if we move to the global level, I think vets have a fantastic role to play in research, in actually developing some of the new technologies, the new tools, which will have a genuinely global impact across animal and human disease. So I think if we were able as a college to be confident that our graduates were going to have that sort of impact across local through to global level, I'd be really very satisfied.
Excellent. Well, it's certainly going to be a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Quentin McKellar, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hope very much you enjoyed that wide-ranging strategic discussion with the principal there, and we hope very much indeed that you'll be joining us again next time on the next edition of the RBC podcast. In the meantime, if you have any questions or comments with regard to the podcasts, please feel free to contact us on podcast@rbc.ac.uk. Thanks very much for listening.